and threatening another false revolution. The story had not stopped where my book had stopped. The story was going on. 200 years on, another Haiti was preparing, I thought, a wish to destroy a world judged corrupt and too full of pain, to turn one's back on it rather than to improve it. After the book I had written, after my 2 years' exaltation, I saw this anger from two sides, from the side of the Negroes, the people with the hair, and also from the side of the Asian Indian community, the people mainly threatened, not black, not white. I went on after a fortnight to St. Kitts and Anguilla to do my articles. St. Kitts was very small, 30,000 people. It had no Asian Indian population, and therefore for me, no personal complication. To the Negroes there I was just a stranger, someone not black, and with straight hair. Judgments could be as simple as that here. This absence of personal complication, the smallness and the simplicity of the geography, made the past extraordinarily graphic. St. Kitts was the earliest British colony in the Caribbean, established in a region from which Spain had withdrawn. In shape it was, apart from a tail, round. It had a central mountain, forested at the top, and the slopes, covered with even sugarcane, ran all the way down to the sea. The island was edged with a narrow asphalt road, and there were the little houses of the workers, descendants of slaves, along this road. Sugar and slavery had created that simplicity, that unnaturalness in the vegetation and landscape. In a shallow, dry ford not far from this literal road, there were boulders in the sugarcane. These boulders were incised with very rough figures, Aboriginal Indian work. The earlier past, a reminder of the horror before slavery. No Aboriginal Indians now existed in St. Kitts. They had been killed off 300 years before by English and French. The rough carvings on those boulders were the only memorials the Indians had left. The accessible past was the English church and churchyard, in a tropical setting. No yews, instead the palms, known as royal palms, with straight and stout grey trunks, with grainy ridges all the way up, like healed wounds, each ridge marking the place where a frond had grown. And how different, in this colonial setting, were the associations of an English churchyard from the associations of a churchyard in England. The past was also accessible in the 18th-century main square, called Pall Mall, of the little town, where newly arrived slaves from Africa were put up for sale after being rested in the barracoons. For 150 years in St. Kitts, the memory of this past had lain dormant. Now, in mimicry of Trinidad and the United States and other places, the memory revived, when the memory had really ceased to humiliate, serving instead as a political stimulus, a communal rhetoric of sentimentality and anger. And in the island of Anguilla, even smaller than St. Kitts, not green, less productive, there was another aspect of that 300-year-old slave simplicity. The people of Anguilla were not pure black. They had their own past. They were separated by that past from the people of St. Kitts. The population of Anguilla, there were about 6,000 people in all, was made up of a few mulatto clans with British names. They had the vaguest idea of their history, of how they had got to that flat barrenness in the Caribbean Sea, so far from the big continents, so far even from the other islands. Some people spoke of a shipwreck. I saw all this under the spell of the book I had written, the past I had discovered far away in England from the documents, and felt I had almost created, as much as my novels had been created. And still under that spell, I went on later to Belize. To do that, I had to go to Jamaica first. From Jamaica, there was one airplane a week. It stopped at Guatemala City. In the dark airport building, beyond the jagged, mud-coloured volcano craters that the airplane landing had shown, like giant anthills or like the extravagant towers of a fairy tale on the level surfaces of which houses clung in clusters, in the lounge of the airport building, when I saw the faces of the short, plump girls behind the counter and saw the fresh vegetable or fresh pepper relishes in the glass case, I remembered that this was absolutely my first time in Central America. My first time in the land laid waste by Cortez and his successors. The girls were Chinese-looking, but they were not Chinese. That half-familiarity made them very strange, remote. And those chopped-up vegetable relishes in the glass case, they suggested a matching strangeness. Foods distinguish cultures and even historical epochs. What would the food of ancient Rome have been like? And I remembered reading somewhere that the chocolate drink consumed by the jar in Montezuma's court was drunk cold and bitter and spiced. In the glimpse of the strange food, in the strange Chinese but not Chinese faces of the girls behind the counter, in the Spanish but not Spanish of the menu boards, in the fairy tale volcanic spires of the land outside, in the vegetables and flowers that grew unnaturally large and bright in the high, clear, temperate air, I had an intimation of the wonder of the new world and the tragedy and pathos of the Spanish usurpation. It was a short flight on to Belize City. Belize, British Honduras, the British intrusion on the coast of the Spanish Empire, the British mahogany colony, the origin of the Guatemalan claim to Belize, the subject of my article, and the source of much of the Georgian furniture in the London sale rooms. But there was no mahogany in Belize now. It had all been cut down. On the coast, there would have been among the Negroes descendants of the slave mahogany log cutters. Inland, there was a Mayan population, and there were mighty Mayan ruins. In the shadow of one such ruin, a Mayan boy, whatever his private emotions, giggled when I tried to talk to him about the monument. He giggled and covered his mouth. He seemed to be embarrassed. He was like a person asking to be forgiven for the absurdities of long ago. Though there was no British colonial architecture worth the name in the mahogany colony, and all the monuments were Mayan. To the north, near the Mexican border and still barely excavated, there was a whole Mayan town, abandoned centuries before the coming of the Spaniards, and now covered by forest, every tall, steep-stepped temple making a green hill. From London to Trinidad, to St. Kitts and Anguilla, Guatemala City and Belize, the journey might have been planned by a man wishing to move backwards in time, to see his history take concrete expression, so that for many weeks after finishing my book, I continued to exist in its aura and exaltation, finding confirmation of the world I had dreamed about and created from the documents. I had given myself a past and a romance of the past. One of the loose ends in my mind had vanished, a little chasm filled. And though something like Haitian anarchy seemed to threaten my little island, and though physically I no longer belonged to the place, yet the romance by which I had attached it to the rest of the world continued to be possessed by me as much as the imaginative worlds of my other fictional books. Still, there was no word about the book I had written, from publisher or agent in the United States. The time came when I had to move on. I stuck to my original plan, which was to go to the United States to travel for a while, using the advance I had hoped to get from the book. I left from Jamaica. It was February. The weather was bad in the north. The plane, just after it crossed Jamaica, landed again at Montego Bay. We stayed there for many hours. A hotel lunch was served by sulky, aggressive Negro waiters who had got too used to waiting on tourists and despised them. Once, more than 12 years before, in a time of anxiety and almost grief, I had left for England from Port Antonio on a banana ship at the other end of the island. In the late afternoon we took off again, and the airplane flew and flew into the night, and then it flew around in the night. We flew for hours. We flew until our fuel was exhausted, and then we landed at Baltimore to take on more fuel. Passengers were not allowed to get off. Baltimore was not an official port of entry. We took off again and flew some more, like hijacked passengers. It was like the slow, slow flight of 19 years before in the little plane of Pan American World Airways, a flight which had set me making notes in my cheap pad every hour. Now we were flying around and unable to land because of the weather, the snow. So we flew until we could land. We landed finally some hours after midnight. No coins. No knowledge of the different sounds made by American telephones. And landing in that great cold, I found the next day, or that day, that my book had been judged unsuitable by the publisher who had commissioned it, that the decision had been made weeks before, while on my journalistic travels I had been uplifted by my own vision of romance, the product of the writing coming at the end of a vocation that had lasted 20 years. I had been briefly in New York twice since 1950, the year of my overnight stay, but the city I had seen on those later occasions had remained quite separate from the first city, the city of Rému and Marius and South Wind and the grey, seemingly canopied sky. It was only now, in a time of anxiety that was like the anxiety of my first arrival, that I thought to look for that city. It was only now that I could begin to acknowledge the humiliation the taxi driver had caused me when he had cheated me, the humiliation I had felt at not being able to tip the Negro in the hotel. I remembered the name of the hotel, the Wellington. I remembered its writing paper on which, for the sake of the drama, I had written my diary on the night of my arrival. On this writing paper, the letters that spelt out the name of the hotel sloped backwards, next to a drawing of what I suppose was the hotel building. Did the hotel still exist? My friend Robert Silvers, who had run my articles on St. Kitts and Anguilla in his paper, the New York Review of Books, said, "It's a hotel where musicians stay." And yet it was astonishing to me to come upon it, one day, a working hotel in a busy street. It should have been an archaeological site, to match its mythical nature in my mind. So modest at pavement level, in spite of the drawing of the skyscraper on the writing paper. Door, lobby, none of these things I had remembered. The hotel had lived in my imagination rather than memory, like something from earliest childhood, an impression of darkness all around. I had arrived early in the morning and was very tired and nervous, and within that darkness, sensations rather than pictures, eating the chicken over the waste paper basket, avoiding the scalding water in the bath cubicle, like dreams rather than memories, and yet suited to the occasion for me. For on that day, space and time had become one. Both space and time separated me from my past at the end of that day, and the writer's journey that had begun that day had not ended. I had planned to spend the advance for the book in the United States. There was no advance, but I stuck to my plan. I spent my own money. It was like watching myself bleed. Eventually I moved away, west. And in Victoria, British Columbia, in a brand new rented flat with rented furniture, I started work again. The writer's life. Whatever one's mood, it was always necessary to pick oneself up and start again. I started on a sequence about freedom and loss. The idea had come to me more than 3 years before in East Africa. It had come suddenly, during the afternoon of a day-long drive between Nairobi in Kenya and Kampala in Uganda. It had come as a mischievous, comic idea, matching the landscape and exhilaration of the long drives I had been used to making in that part of Africa. Now the idea was all that I had at the moment in the way of writer's capital, and it was touched with a mood of the historical book I had written, my disappointment and the homelessness, the drifting about I had imposed on myself. I had, as it were, and as had happened often before, become one of my own characters. After some weeks I came to the end of my original impulse and could go no further with the writing. I lost faith in what I was doing. The days in Victoria, which had passed easily when I was writing, began to drag. And then I faced the simple fact that as a man who made his living by writing in English and had no American audience, I had only England to go back to, that my wish to be free of the English heaviness had failed, that my departure from my island in 1950, with all that it implied in homelessness and drift and longing, was final. From Victoria to Vancouver, the very tall stewardesses in the very short skirts, a dreadful frivolity. Toronto, London. The grind and grind of the airplane engines, hour after hour, stages in a return I didn't want. So that 20 years on, I was making a journey that mimicked my first. If 20 years before I could have been granted a glimpse of myself as a writer, someone with a talent that had been developed and with books to his name, I would have considered myself blessed. The blessings I felt as a blessing still, but, as with the pain that attends love, the disappointment that had come with the blessing I felt as a terrible solitude. I had no house. In London I rented a serviced flat in Dolphin Square. It consumed my money in steady instalments, every week so much. The bills came up in a woman's handwriting, round, easy, the lower line of the writing creating a regular, almost scalloped, pattern. The handwriting spoke of a woman absolutely at peace, sexually fulfilled, without anxiety. I envied her this calm, this absence of ambition, and when I went down to the office to settle the bill, I tried to work out which of the women it was, among the clerks who might have passed as wage slaves, which woman it was who, perhaps without knowing how blessed she was, had written out the figures of my fierce, debilitating demand. The summer was over. For the first time in England after 19 years, I felt cold, imperfectly clad. Until this time I had had the same kind of clothes summer and winter, and had not felt the need for a pullover, or for warm underclothes, or even an overcoat. I had longed for frosty weather, short days, electric lights in the early afternoon. Now, with this need for warm clothes, a need that seemed to grow and grow, I felt the winter as winter, darkness. One day there were workmen somewhere below my window. They began to talk to one another. It was like listening to a play. Different voices, careful dialogue, characters, sentences, ideas, showing off, acting, style. In all my time in England I had never heard workmen talk like that, among themselves, so loudly in the open air, for so long. It was a little frightening, this eavesdropping on what was like an unknown country. I knew another side of England, Oxford, people in broadcasting, writers. I had never been brought into contact like this with the country I had been living in for so long. I hadn't read about working men like the ones I was now listening to. I hadn't seen films about them. I went eventually to stay in a private house in the town of Gloucester. It was a wet day. The railway station was cold, damp, indicating the nearness of the River Severn. Gloucester, away from its grand cathedral, was a small, mean, common town. It was not a place I would have gone to out of choice, but now it offered a house, shelter, hospitality. The house was at the edge of the town, mean houses making mean the fields they had been set down among, the pollarded willows, the narrow tainted brooks in which industrial litter floated, willows and brooks like features of city slum. It was not a house I would have chosen, but it was a home for someone, and had been furnished like that, and had the atmosphere. It was welcoming. At lunchtime on this first day the house also offered a coal fire. The French windows looked out onto a long, narrow garden, scrupulously stripped and forked over for the winter. Far off were the sounds of a railway marshalling yard, oddly comforting at this distance. Everything about this house was welcoming and good, and in this unambitious setting I felt protected, isolated, far from every wounding thing I had known. For the first time in many weeks, I felt at ease. That afternoon, in the front room of the house where the furniture was old but cared for, I looked for the first time for weeks at the typescript of the book I had tried to get started on in Victoria, the sequence about freedom and loss. I found it better than I had during the writing. I even saw the sentence where it had come alive, a sentence written out of concentration, from within the mood created by the words. That critical, creative moment had been missed by me in Victoria, perhaps because of my anxiety about what was to follow in the writing, and perhaps as well because of my anxiety about what was to follow Victoria. Now, recognizing the validity of that good sentence, I surrendered to the pictures the words created, the other pictures they trailed. I summoned up again and sank back into the mood of Africa, the mood out of which the sentence had been written. I heard, or created, snatches of dialogue from different stages of my story. This particular story in the sequence was full of dialogue. I made brief notes, and it was only when I came back from the mood or came out of the concentration that I understood how far away I had been. In my early days as a writer, when my talent was declaring itself, I had developed, or discovered, this ability to concentrate and to compose in the midst of harassment, which was an ability, given a clear run of an hour or two, shorter periods didn't work, suddenly to withdraw, to shed even acute anxiety, like an engine cutting out when too much was asked of it, to push the world to one side, and to enter my writing as I might enter a walled garden or enclosure, the image that often came to my mind. Writing strengthened me. It quelled anxiety. And now writing restored me again. My book was given back to me. I began to write slowly, day by day. The book of the summer was given back to me in the winter. Without the book and the daily act of creation, I do not know how I would have gone through that difficult time. With me, everything started from writing. Writing had brought me to England, had sent me away from England, had given me a vision of romance, had nearly broken me with disappointment. Now it was writing, the book, that gave savour, possibility to each day and took me on night after night. I had intended to stay for a week or so in Gloucester. I stayed nearly 3 months, unwilling, apart from everything else, to cut myself off from the good magic of the place. Several weeks of original composition lay ahead of me when I left Gloucester and went to Wiltshire, to the valley. For the first 4 days it rained and was misty. I could hardly see where I was. It was a good way of making the transition from the front room of the Gloucester house, which had been kind to me, kind to my African creation. It was good for the book, which was still in the delicate, suggestible state of its first draft. When a book was in that state, things around me could get written into it, could become part of the emotional charge of the narrative, and, once written into a book, hard to take out. So I tried, during the composing of a book, to avoid disturbance. And that Wiltshire Valley fog was right. In my imagination, at that stage of my story, I was living in a made-up Africa, a fairy tale landscape that mixed, according to my need, the high, rainy plateau of Rwanda with the wet, terraced, cultivated hills of Kigezi in western Uganda. As a child in Trinidad, I had projected everything I read onto the Trinidad landscape, the Trinidad countryside, the Port of Spain streets. Even Dickens and London I incorporated into the streets of Port of Spain. Were the characters English, white people, or were they transformed into people I knew? A question like that is a little like asking whether one dreams in colour or in black and white. But I think I transferred the Dickens characters to people I knew. Though with a half or a quarter of my mind I knew that Dickens was all English, yet my Dickens cast, the cast in my head, was multiracial. That ability to project what I read onto Trinidad, the colonial, tropical, multiracial world which was the only world I knew, that ability diminished as I grew older. It was partly as a result of my increasing knowledge, self-awareness, and my embarrassment at the workings of my fantasy. It was also partly because of the writers. Very few had the universal child's eye of Dickens, and that gift of fantasy became inoperable as soon as I came to England in 1950. When I was surrounded by the reality, English literature ceased to be universal, since it ceased to be the subject of fantasy. Now, in Wiltshire, in winter, a writer now rather than a reader, I worked the child's fantasy the other way. I projected the solitude and emptiness and menace of my Africa onto the land around me. And when 4 days later the fog lifted and I went walking, something of the Africa of my story adhered to the land I saw. I walked out between the stripped beaches and between the old, untrimmed yews, solid and dark green, and along the public road, past the cottages of flint and brick and thatch, but not yet seen clearly, and up the hill beside the windbreak to the barn at the top. I saw Stonehenge from a gap in the windbreak, a very wide view, the downs pimpled with tumuli and barrows. I walked down the hill to the farm buildings at the bottom. I asked a man the way to Stonehenge. He told me to go on past the farm buildings and then turn to the right, along the wide grassed way. Around the farm the ground was muddy, churned up by tractor tires. Water, puddles, reflected the grey sky. The grass on the grassed way, up the slope to the barrows, from which a closer view of Stonehenge was to be had, the grass was tall and wet and entangling. Another day I walked along the public road in another direction, towards Salisbury. I came to a marked footpath. It was muddy, the mud deep. I turned back after about 200 or 300 yards. As once, 4 years before, in Kigezi in Uganda, getting out of the car one rainy afternoon, to be in a village with separate little terraced hills and huts and afternoon smoke, wishing to be in the middle of that enchanting view, I found myself mired in animal excrement, tormented by the stares and constant approaches of Africans who were puzzled by my intrusion, and I had had to turn away, get back into the car, drive on. I didn't explore too much on the public road after that. I left all the marked public footpaths untrodden. I stuck to the downs, the grassed droveway, the walks around the farm at the bottom of the valley, and I continued easily in that rhythm of creation and walk. Africa in the writing in the morning, Wiltshire in the hour and a half or so after lunch. I projected Africa onto Wiltshire. Wiltshire, the Wiltshire I walked in, began to radiate or return Africa to me. So man and writer became one. The circle became complete. The Africa of my imagination was not only the source countries, Kenya, Uganda, the Congo, Rwanda. It was also Trinidad, to which I had gone back with a vision of romance and had seen black men with threatening hair. It also now became Wiltshire. It was also the land created by my pain and exhaustion, expressed in the dream of the exploding head. A little over a year before, towards the end of the book about the New World, I had had the waking fantasy of myself as a corpse, tossing lightly among the reeds at the bottom of a river. A river like the one in the pre-Raphaelite painting of the drowned Ophelia, reproduced in the Nelson's West Indian Reader I had used in my elementary school in Trinidad, a river that turned out to be like the river in Wiltshire at the back of my cottage. Now, every night, at some stage, an explosion in my head, occurring in a swift dream, giving me the conviction that this time I had to die, that this time I could not survive the great continuing noise, awakened me. Such violence in my Africa, in the security of my stone cottage, where I had a coal fire every night, so much had gone into that Africa of my fantasy. As a point of rest, as a refreshment, a promise of release, I allowed myself to play lightly with the ancient Mediterranean idea that had come to me from the Chirico painting, the enigma of arrival. The empty wharf, the glimpse of the mast of the ancient ship, the doorways, the wicked, hypnotizing city towards which the two cloaked figures walk. For 2 days they had sailed, staying close to the shore. On the third day the captain wakened his deck passenger and pointed to the city on the shore. "There! You are there! Your journey's over!" But the passenger, looking at the city in the morning haze, seeing the unremarkable city debris floating out on the sea, unremarkable though the city was so famous, rotten fruit, fresh branches, bits of timber, driftwood, the passenger had a spasm of fear. He sipped the bitter honey drink the captain had given him. He pretended to get his things together, but he didn't want to leave the ship. But he would have to land. Such adventures were to come to him within the cut-out, sunlit walls of that city. So classical that city, seen from the ship, so alien within, so strange its gods and cults. My hero would end as a man on the run, a man passionate to get away to a clearer air. In desperation he was to go through a doorway, and he was to find himself on the wharf again. But there was no mast above the walls of the wharf, no ship. His journey, his life's journey, had been made. It did not occur to me that the story that had come to me as a pleasant fantasy had already occurred, and was an aspect of my own. I had no means of knowing that the landscape by which I was surrounded was in fact benign. The first landscape to have that quality for me, that I was to heal here, and more, that I was to have something like a second life here, that those first 4 days of fog, before I went out walking on the downs, were like a rebirth for me, that after 20 years in England I was to learn about the seasons here at last, that at last, as for a time as a child in Trinidad, I would learn to link certain natural events, leaves on trees, flowers, the clarity of the river, to certain months, that in the most unlikely way, at an advanced age in a foreign country, I was to find myself in tune with a landscape in a way that I had never been in Trinidad or India, both sources of different kinds of pain, that all the resolutions and franknesses I was going to arrive at through my writing were to be paralleled by the physical peace of my setting, that I was to be cleansed in heart and mind, and that for 10 years I was to turn this landscape of down and barrow, so far from my own, into the setting for concentrated work. The man who went walking past Jack's cottage saw things as if for the first time. Literary allusions came naturally to him, but he had grown to see with his own eyes. He could not have seen like that so clearly 20 years before. And having seen, he might not have found the words or the tone. The simplicity and directness had taken a long time to get to him. It was necessary for him to have gone through a lot. A long time later, seeking as always a synthesis of my material, my worlds, my own developing way of seeing, I thought of the present book and returned to live in the past. And it was actually during the writing of the first chapter or section that I remembered something from the first week of my time in London, when I was staying in Angela's boarding house. My writer's ambition, my social inexperience and anxiety, had suppressed so much of that empty time, had expunged so much from my memory. I used to go out doing the sights. It was what tourists did. And one day, somewhere in central London, perhaps along the embankment, I saw someone from the SS Columbia sitting on a bench below a statue. He was like part of a monument. He was in a dark suit, a small man hot in the month of August. The month and the weather were fitted together later by the writer. He was tired. He had been doing the sights and possibly having as little idea of what he was doing as I had. Travel was a pleasure so much in the mind, so much something for later narrative. He was a butler, I thought, the man from the Columbia. Perhaps he had told me that on the ship, or perhaps I had made it up, finding in him a resemblance to a butler in some film. He was slightly offhand with me. It was as the night watchman had said during the gala night on the Columbia, when he had lectured those of us who were outside the dance lounge on the quirks of human behaviour. After 3 days on a ship, everyone was faithless, he had said. On shore, though, people became themselves again and forgot shipboard romances and even acquaintances. The butler was going on to France. A week there, no doubt in Paris, more sights, and then another ship would take him from Le Havre or Cherbourg back to New York, and the wandering holiday life would be over. He would be back home, free of hotels and the daily tramping and the fatigue and the strange food, and I passionately wanted to go with him. I didn't want to be his companion or talk to him or be in his house or apartment. I wanted to be as he was at that moment, a man on the move. I passionately wanted, though hardly arrived in London, to be free of London. I didn't want to go back home, though. I knew there was nothing there. I just wanted that day, trying to engage the offhand butler in conversation, trying to claim acquaintance with him in the strangeness of London. I wanted that day to feel that England was temporary for me too. Like the character in the story that came to me 20 years after, when I first came to the valley, I wanted to stay with the ship. More than 10 years after I had moved to the valley, when I was almost at the end of my time there, my time in the manor cottage, my second life, I was strongly reminded of my first week in England. I had a letter from Angela. I hadn't heard from her, or about her, for 30 years. Even her name had ceased to be familiar. It was something I had to fumble for when I thought back to those early days, and this letter from Angela was more than a word or a note. It was many pages long, written over many days, and, as the handwriting showed, written in many moods. It was a round, fluent, thin-nibbed hand, now erect, now leaning to the right. Now the lines were straight, now crooked, now the letters were carefully shaped, now they moved up and down and were left unfinished. But the writing had an essential mode. It was the feminine English hand, round and fluent, the round shapes of the letters occasionally flattened, becoming wider than they were tall, egg shapes, speaking of a passive sensuality. The Englishness of the handwriting was a surprise. It was as though, purely by living in England, Angela had acquired that hand. The envelope carried the postmark of a town in Buckinghamshire, middle-class, commuter country. The surname Angela gave, in brackets, at the end of her letter, was English. I had forgotten her Italian surname, having seldom used it, but this English name seemed odd, seemed not to go with a person I knew. Yet she had given me an English name the first day we met. She called me Victor. She said that my Hindi or Sanskrit name was too hard for her, and she didn't intend to try to use it. 30 years later, she remembered the name. Dear Victor. I was surprised. But perhaps no one, except very famous actors and dancers and sportsmen and people in the entertainment world who live by the physical admiration they receive from other people, perhaps no one forgets an admirer. And this may be truer of women, who, as they get older, must check over and over and count lovers and adventures. Dear Victor. And it worked for me, too. Through all the intervening sensualities, all the uses to which I had put my body, the name Angela had given me called up the enigma and false promise of that early time in London, and Angela's waitress clothes and red lips. It even called up the feel of her fur coat, in which, according to her story, she had run away from her lover's room or flat one night when he had turned too violent. It called up the feel of her breasts, the liberty she permitted in her room when other people, her friends, displaced people from Europe and North Africa, were there. It called up what I had very nearly forgotten, because there had been so much real writing since my attempts in those days, out of my great ignorance, to turn Angela into suitable material. How often I had written about her, her breasts, her fur coat. How often I had introduced myself, how often I had improved or sought to improve everybody's circumstances. She had heard me on the radio, she wrote. She had heard me many times and even seen me on television, but hadn't thought of troubling me until now. She reintroduced herself, and she rewrote her past as once I had done. She said she managed the hotel in Kensington, where I had stayed before going up to Oxford. Nothing about the Italian restaurant in the Earl's Court Road. I don't think you know, but I had a daughter in Italy. My sister was looking after her until I could send for her. Well, Victor, this daughter is now a grown woman of 35, with children, and a lovely baby girl of her own, and speaking English, you wouldn't know she was Italian. That was the end of the first part of the letter, all of it written in one kind of handwriting, regular, swift, strong, faltering only towards the end. After this, the lines began to slope, the letters leaning more sharply, the spacing irregular. Much time, perhaps days, had passed since she had written the first part of the letter. I used to walk out with someone you didn't like at all, and to tell you the truth, Victor, I didn't care for him all that much. But it was the war. Things looked different then. You get mixed up with strange people. You hate the priests, you don't care what they say, and you know that youth is ignorant. Walk out. Extraordinary language. I had never heard the phrase used by anybody, so dainty, quaint, so old-fashioned sounding and coy for Angela's association with a violent man who was a criminal and was probably in jail when I got to know her. They had met during the war in Italy. She had been glad to follow him from the mess of Italy after the war to the peace and order of London, though of London she would have known as little as I. It got bad after you went to Oxford and stopped coming to the hotel. I was getting like one of these battered wives you read about in the papers these days, only I wasn't a wife. And he started coming to the hotel, and carrying on many a time I thought I was for the sack. But then one day somebody came to the hotel, a tall man in a tweed jacket, and the second time he talked to me with his level, steady gaze, I felt he had been sent by God himself, Victor. You know I am no great believer, but I saw the hand of God there, I must say. I went to the Catholic Church and lighted a candle, which I hadn't done since I was a child. When your good friend heard what was happening, he came over hot-foot to the hotel, ready for blood. I don't know what he expected. But as soon as he saw the man he had to deal with, he went crazy. It was pathetic. It made me ashamed. He was like a man ready to cry. Class is class. I saw it then. The English gentleman, Victor, you cannot beat it. You cannot say you know England until you know the English gentleman. Our good friend went away with his tail between his legs, but then up to his old tricks, as per usual, he began to telephone me, effing and dashing every other word, going on and on about the tweed coat. The man in the tweed coat married Angela, though again she knew as little of his background or the life to which he was taking her as she had done of the man she had first followed to England. She brought her daughter over from Italy, and they all lived in Buckinghamshire until her husband died. In Angela's letter, those many happy years were passed over quickly. The man who had given her those happy years was hardly a presence. Most of Angela's letter was about matters that had happened since the death of her husband, her saviour, Most of Angela's letter was about her daughter, the daughter whom Angela had left behind as a child in Italy for some years, to follow, for very good reasons, her rough lover to London. The daughter had been brought over to live in Angela's Buckinghamshire house, had been sent to the local school, but suddenly, growing up, the daughter had declared herself Angela's enemy. The daughter's boyfriends had been wrong, according to Angela, and then the daughter's husband had been very wrong, had even been to jail. Daughter and husband tormented Angela, and this had become especially bad since Angela's husband had died. They had turned their children against Angela. They had forbidden Angela to come to their house. This was the burden of the largest part of Angela's letter. It was of this, rather than of the past, that she had settled down to write. This was the letter she had written at different times, in different moods, with different degrees of stability, in different versions of the handwriting she would no doubt have picked up from both her daughter, educated at the local school, and her husband. And this part of the letter was hard to read. It was very much like the letters I received sometimes from obsessed people, addressed to me but not really meant for me. I couldn't read it in a connected way. I read it in snatches, jumping from page to page. But this I know, Victor, the little girl will grow up and learn to use the phone, though her mother doesn't think so, and the little girl will want to telephone her gran who loves her. You have my address and telephone number, Victor. I don't have yours. Please telephone, and let us meet and talk over the good old days, always the best, I say. I read this letter in my cottage. I felt my surroundings very acutely, felt their foreignness, felt the unrelatedness of my presence there. Beyond the garden wall and where the water meadows began were the great aspens. There had been three. They had made a giant fan. I had watched them grow. In the gales of one winter I had actually been watching when two of the giant aspens had snapped, twice, leaving jagged, raw stumps. The stumps had grown to look less raw. There were powerful shoots from the stumps. I had trained myself not to feel grief for things like that. I trained myself in the belief that change was constant. On the other side of the cottage, the view in one direction was of the water meadows, seen beyond the fast-growing wild sycamores and the tall, unpruned box hedge. In the other direction, there were the old beeches, the yews, the dark, overshadowed lane to the road. Though I had never noted it down, I had had an intimation of a world in flux, a disturbed world, when I had first seen Angela and her friends in Earl's Court. We had both, it seemed, continued to travel versions of our old route. We had both made circular journeys, returning from time to time to something like our starting point. I didn't go to see her. I didn't telephone her. It would have been physically hard for me to go to where she was, and her disturbance, her instability, which perhaps had always existed and which perhaps as an ardent young man I couldn't see, preferring to see the shape and colour of her mouth, her instability, created no doubt by the terrible war and then her time in a London which she could hardly have understood, that was too unsettling to me. I preserved my own balance with difficulty. I was also deep in a book. My thoughts were of a whole new generation of young people in remote countries, made restless and uncertain in the late 20th century, not by travel, but by the undoing of their old certainties, and looking for false consolation in the mind-quelling practices of a simple, revealed religion. Angela took me back to the past. I wasn't living there, intellectually and imaginatively, any longer. My world and my themes had come to me long after I had ceased to write of Angela. Her letter was soon covered over by the paper that accumulated in various piles in various places in my cottage. After some months, it would not have been possible for me to get at it easily. She never wrote again. Ivy. I never spoke to my landlord. And in all my years as his tenant I saw him, or had a glimpse of him, only once. There was another glimpse, but that was even briefer, was from a distance and was of his back. The true glimpse came on the public road one afternoon at the end of my walk, and I was so little prepared for it, and it was so brief, that I couldn't say afterwards what my landlord looked like. That day I hadn't done the walk up the Lark Hills to the Barrows and the closer view of Stonehenge. I had done the other, shorter walk on flatter ground. At the farmyard at the bottom of the hill I had turned down the wide, straight stretch of the driveway, bisected for some time now by the barbed wire fence. It was there, down the free part of the wide way, that I had seen Jack driving back early one Sunday afternoon after his midday drinking at the pub, bumping and banging along in his old car, ploughing through the tussocky grass like a launch in choppy water. And it was along that way that on the Christmas Saturday before he died, he had driven his car twice, once out, once back, to have his last evening with his friends in the pub. On the barbed wire fence there were still the shredded remains of one or two of the plastic sack paddings Jack's father-in-law had rolled at his crossing places, and at intervals down that way there were the older relics Jack would have known. On one side, the empty, abandoned grey beehives sat down in the grass in two crooked rows. On the other side, in the shade of bush and silver birch, the abandoned gypsy caravan with its cambered roof and variegated colours, the caravan itself still appearing in working order. Further on that same side, past the young wood, there was the old hayrick, shaped like a cottage, and covered with the black plastic sheeting that had over the years grown ragged at the edges, had lost its shine and its ability to crackle, and had thinned and weathered to a texture like that of a faded rose petal or the skin of a very old person. Beyond that, the mysterious house ruin, all walls with a boundary line of sycamores that had grown tall, those regularly spaced sycamores, now like part of the mystery of the place. When they were planted, and for many years afterwards, the seedlings or saplings would have seemed far apart, and would have made no impression in the wide way. Now the crowns of foliage on the sturdy trunks met and cast a solid, cold shade, in which even in the hottest summer no grass could grow. The earth, though flinty, was always damp and black around that ruin, like ground trodden on by sheep. The straight stretch of the driveway ended in an abrupt, bare slope, marked with lines and welts and indentations that suggested old agriculture or old fortifications. The way itself curved, to run beside this slope, which, though not high, shut out a further view and led the eye up to the sky. Nothing now on that striated, antique hillside. Hardly pasture. Only a water trough, no grass around it, the flinty soil trampled into black mud. From time to time steers, on the upper slope, outlined against the old sky, were penned there, blank, healthy, heavy-bellied, responsive to every human approach, waiting now only for the covered trailer and the trip along the winding valley road to the slaughterhouse in the town. On the other side of the way there was a wide, tilled field that led gently up to a wood. The tilling of such flinty soil, and the flints could be big and heavy, was new. I had been told that it had started only during the war, when the discovery was made that, in addition, of course, to fertilizer, ground like that needed to be merely scratched rather than deeply ploughed. In the wood at the top were reared pheasants for shooting, pheasants which, when grown, wandered all over the valley. It was in that wood that I had gone walking during my very first week in the valley, and, in a muddy lane overhung with trees, I had later learned to be blackthorn, I had met Jack's father-in-law. The driveway here was deeply rutted, tall grass growing in tufts on the ridges, the ruts themselves narrow and bare and flinty, with loose gravel. Hard to walk on, ankle-turning. On this path, one day, during my first or second year, when hares still delighted me, and I looked for them during every walk, I had seen the dusty, ragged, half-rotted-away carcass of a hare. The area was famous for its hares. A traveller in the previous century, William Cobbett, had once seen, not far away from here, a field full of hares. And there were still hare shoots, curiously feudal occasions in one way, with hired beaters driving the animals over the downs towards the shooters, hidden behind bales of hay on the driveway. And at the same time, occasions on which landowners and labourers and men from the small towns round about were at one, united by old country instincts. Perhaps the hare had been shot during one of those shoots. Perhaps the wounded animal had been mangled and dragged out to the driveway by a dog. Dead and soon useless, soon less than carrion, it had perhaps been turned over inquisitively by a farm worker or walker, kicked or pushed along a deep rut, and left finally to dry and moulder away. What mighty hind legs, folded in death. Such a skeleton, or something that reminded me of it, I saw again more than 10 years later, on a high rocky islet midway in the narrow channel between southwestern Trinidad and Venezuela. This was an islet of pelicans and frigate birds, but pelicans above all. Here pelicans lived and also died. In the central dips of the islet, the ground was springy with guano, and on the rock ledges there were whole pelican skeletons, as though, knowing themselves to be in their sanctuary, the big birds had folded their powerful wings and settled down to die. The pelican bones on that islet, called by the Spaniards soldado, the soldier, and afterwards by the English soldier's rock, looked like the strong hind legs, bones within dusty fur, of that hare. The antique bare slope at one side of the droveway receded and became high and steep, so that there was something like a field or paddock on that side of the droveway. There was a pond in this field, and at various points down the high, steep slope, trees had been planted. The inexplicable little pond, the abruptness and height of the slope, the scattered trees, the land here had a feeling of oddity, ancientness, even sanctity. The elms in the paddock or field at the foot of the steep slope had all been cut down, like the elms all over the valley, and showed now only as level stumps sawn off about a foot or so above the ground. There were one or two horses in the paddock, unbridled, broad-backed, with muzzles perhaps a little too sloping. They looked heavy, primitive animals, and as emblematic as everything else in that setting. The pond, the paddock, the elm stumps, the steep green slope with the scattered trees, each tree casting a perfect shadow. As though, as in a primitive painting, every element here had to be perfectly realized, separately realized. In the very simplicity and clarity of the view there was a kind of mystery. It linked neither to the bare downs to which it led in one direction, nor to the lush river vegetation, the water meadows to which it led in the other direction. The rutted droveway, running past little houses and gardens, one of them the old farm manager's house with its full, many-coloured suburban English garden, became paved, and then, very quickly losing mystery, met the public road. This road ran on a ledge, or cutting in the down just above the river. It was the road Jack, after his drinking that Sunday lunchtime, had decided not to take. There was a steep drop down to the river. To the right there was a weir, and beyond, water meadows that were like the water meadows Constable had painted 150 years before. After antiquity, Constable, and also the more recent past. It was of Augustus John that I had first thought. Very vaguely, when I had seen the gypsy caravan across the droveway from Jack's cottage and the old farm buildings. Then, after I had got to know the book, the caravan brought to mind, at the same time as it gave a reality to, the drawings and coloured illustrations by E. H. Shepherd for The Wind in the Willows. That book itself, about a river like the one I now saw, still seemed new, contemporary. And the paint on the caravan, which appeared to be in such good order and seemed to have been temporarily parked, was still so bright that it was easy to imagine that the caravan might be on the road again one day, and that just around the corner on the droveway, by the silver birches, say, one might come upon the old world in which that caravan once had a real place going on. Just in this way now the water meadows had the effect, in one corner of the mind, of abolishing the distance between Constable and the present. The painter, the man with his colours and brushes and boards, seemed as near and contemporary as what he made us now see. The water channels and pollarded willows he had settled down one day to paint. This idea of the painter, this glimpse of the painter's view, made the past ordinary. The past was like something one could stretch out and reach. It was like something physically before one, like something one could walk in. Shepherd and Constable. They had imposed their vision on an old landscape. But on their vision was imposed something else now, a modern picturesque. Beeches as old as the century lined the narrow road. Hundreds, thousands of young beeches grew on the leaf-strewn slope between the main row of beeches at the edge of the down and the asphalted road, and thousands more on the steeper slope from the road down to the river. All the shades of delicate, light-shot green, of overlapping, transparent green leaves hung over the road. This was the scenic drive the taxi drivers of the town took visitors along. The beeches had been planted at the turn of the century by the father of my landlord, and were now like a natural, wasting monument of the father's grandeur. This grandeur had come from the consolidation and extension in imperial times of a family fortune established earlier, during the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution. The family had its roots elsewhere. Many branches of the family now flourished elsewhere, but my landlord lived on here, where once his family had owned nearly all the land and many of the houses, in a few acres beside the river. And it was here, on this road at the end of my walk, below the trees planted by his father before he, the son, had been born, that I had my first and only true glimpse of my landlord. It was a confused glimpse. The road was narrow, curving. I was nervous of the car, as I was nervous of all cars or vehicles on this stretch of road with its blind curves. Then, rather late, I saw that it was the manor car. Then I thought to look for Mr. Phillips, and to acknowledge him. Mr. Phillips was smiling. It was a friendly, happy smile, and it was odd, in a man whose manner and instincts were authoritarian and protective, and whose usual expression in public was one of sternness and irritability. The smile, then, the conviviality and relaxedness of it, told me that the occasion was special, and his passenger was special. And I knew at once, I had an immediate idea that the person sitting beside Mr. Phillips was my landlord, the man in the manor, the man I had got used to not seeing. And before, forgetting Mr. Phillips's smile and the dangers of the road, I could properly focus on the stranger, the car had gone. This was my only glimpse of my landlord. His face. And I wasn't sure what I had seen. I had an impression of a round face, a bald head, a suit, or the jacket of a brown suit, a benign expression. What I most clearly remembered, it was the detail I was sure of, not the kind of detail that imagination could supply, was a low, slow wave of a hand. A wave just above the dashboard, so that from the road I saw the tips of his fingers making an arc at the bottom of the windshield. We had never met. Mr. Phillips must have told him who I was, and, in spite of the bad sight he was said to have, one of his many afflictions, he must have seen me before I had seen him. And secure in the car with Mr. Phillips at his side, he must have seen me more clearly than I had seen him. My glimpse had been so hurried, so shot through with the confusion of the moment, coming at the end of a swift sequence of little alarms and recognitions, that I wasn't sure whether my imagination, as instantaneously as in a dream, hadn't suggested certain of the details I thought I had seen, to supply me with a picture of the man I had more or less created in my head already. I had an impression of benignity above the wave, but I had cause to question that impression when I spoke to Mr. Phillips on the telephone in the evening. With a laugh that was like a carryover from the smiling good humour I had seen in him in the car that afternoon, he said yes. The man I had seen in the car was my landlord. And then, as though explaining my doubt, Mr. Phillips said, "He always wears dark glasses in the car. Otherwise his stomach gets upset and then he gets a migraine." How, then, if he had been wearing dark glasses, had I seen a benign expression in his eyes? So this glimpse of my landlord, this glimpse of someone unexpectedly ordinary, made him, after all, more mysterious. And more than the man, it was the occasion that was memorable, the manor car, with the descendant of the manor builder and the planter of the trees, driving below the beeches on the ledge at the rim of the down, just above the river and the water meadows. So that, more than ever for me, the personality of the man continued to be expressed by his setting, by these beeches on the public road, by the permanently closed front gate of the manor and the overgrown garden at the back. My imagination had given me a glimpse of a benign elderly man in a brown jacket making a shy wave from his car. This picture, created in a flash as the car had gone by, answered my own need. It was how I wished to think of the man in whose grounds I had so unexpectedly, for the first time in my adult life, found myself at peace. I soon learned that the picture wasn't true. Neither was the other picture which I carried, a contrary, slightly sinister picture I had allowed my fantasy to work up from details given then and at other times by Mr. Phillips, of a fat, round-faced man buttoned up in a suit with dark glasses and a hat, being taken out for a spin through countryside he would never otherwise see, being taken out for thrilling but safe glimpses safe, as for a child standing behind a rail at the top of a tower and looking down, of the world from which he had withdrawn. Yet never too thrilling. Not London, for instance. Just the countryside, and the houses of a few people he knew